Time set for argument in case number 83685, the state of Nevada versus Jeremias. Are the parties ready to proceed? And we're set for a 30-minute argument today, 15 minutes per side. There's a cross appeal, correct?
That's true.
So I'm not sure how you guys are dividing the argument. Have you considered how you're dividing your time? Or are you reserving for rebuttal is what I mean to say?
Yes, I think about 10 to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Are you going to try to reserve time for rebuttal on your cross?
I had not anticipated doing that, but see for this on
Texas. Okay. All right, counsel, go ahead and step up and proceed then.
Good morning, Deputy District Attorney Elon Eldar, on behalf of the appellant to the state of Nevada. May it please the court. The district court erred in two very important ways. First, by holding respondent's trial counsel to a higher standard than what is required in Strickland. And second, by holding respondents' burden to establish prejudice to a lower standard. And in doing that, it eroded the scrupulous care in which Strickland must be applied, turning the high bar of Strickland into an easy task that it is not designed to be. Now, looking at the district court's findings as to the deficiency, I think that both the state and the respondent agree on the underlying facts of Mr. Cano's efforts, being that Mr. Cano received a letter from Daniel Carrillo through the respondent's parents, and once receiving that letter, Mr. Cano reached out to Daniel Carrillo's attorney at the time, Mr. Langford, and was then denied access to that client to speak to him. By the district court ruling that to be ineffective is to say more than Mr. Cano could have done something differently or that a different attorney would have done something differently. Rather, it is to say that not pursuing it beyond speaking to his counsel, Mr. Langford, is to entirely deprive the respondent of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now,
well, counsel, is that the test?
What is that?
Is that the test under Strickland?
Well, the test under Strickland is that, one, that counsel's representations fall below the wide range of reasonable professional assistance, and that there are errors that are so serious as to deprive a fair trial.
Okay, but when we're talking about deficient performance, right, it's fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, right? It's not perhaps as high as I think you just stated.
So the language that I use that's so serious there, I believe, comes directly from that Harrington versus Richter case that the state cited to. But the question itself as to deficiency, the district court made three separate findings. Well, three separate courses of action as to which trial counsel should have pursued. The first of those was that it should have went to the court and requested a court order to speak with Daniel Carrillo. The second is that it should have kept track of the attorneys that were representing Daniel Carrillo throughout the course of his trial, appeal, and post-conviction. And finally, that they should have spoken with him after his appeal and post-conviction process was over. And to find that Mr. Cano's actions must have involved one of those three things is to create an untenable rule for what attorneys must do.
Did the counsel do anything other than ask Carrillo's then attorney to speak with him? Did he take any efforts after that to do anything else to procure some statements or testimony from Mr. Carrillo?
So the record from the evidentiary hearing shows that Mr. Cano reached out to Mr. Langford, was denied access to the client, and it appears to be that he believed that he needed to speak to have Mr. Langford's permission. There was nothing pursued after that.
Do you agree that that was an inaccurate belief on his part?
So I think that you have to look at what Rule 4.2 requires. What Rule 4.2 requires is that to discuss something about the scope of the representation, you need permission from, in this case, Mr. Langford, and you would otherwise need to get a court order authorized by some law to be able to bypass that requirement. In terms of the court order, it is entirely unclear from my review of the case law in Nevada what would be required to get a court order from the judge at that time to bypass the advice of his counsel or the representations of his counsel that isn't going to speak to you, to then try to at least confront Daniel Carrillo, who by all means is permitted under the law to not speak with Mr. Khanna.
Right, but he provided a letter. Why would he not speak to him?
So the letter itself, which I think there are concerns with the letter itself, but why he might not speak to him is that he is currently sitting in custody on murder charges. And after speaking with Mr. Langford, his attorney might decide, wait a second, I don't want to really put myself under oath, which potentially that everything in that letter is not true. And
okay, counsel, but after his case resolved, there was still time before this trial started.
And that is correct. There is a period of time after his case resolved and after or between the start of trial. But the state's position is that trial counsel does not need to be monitoring Daniel Carrillo's case after the fact. The moment that he reached out.
Even though he says that the key witness in this capital murder trial acknowledged he was lying about his story. It's still not worth calendaring every 30 days to follow up on what's happening, or every 60 days or every 90 days.
And that, I think, is the difference between what an attorney could possibly do under their scope of their representation versus what is necessary and mandated by the law.
You don't think that's what the reasonable standard of care requires?
No. I do not believe that an attorney needs to create some kind of, that some kind of rule needs to be created that after you speak to the party that is representing this witness and ask that party to, if it is possible to speak with Daniel Carrillo, and once denied, that you then need to set calendar appointments every 30 days or 60 days or 90 days beyond that fact.
So let me ask you a question, and there's something that's kind of come up with the questions that have been asked and Justice Bell's question about, well, why would he not testify if he wrote the letter? I'm concerned that there is nothing in the record about whether he would or would not have testified, that the court jumped from Mr. Carrillo, you knew about him, you should have done more, to here's how it would have potentially impacted a verdict if he had testified, but without there being anything showing whether he would have or not. And I don't necessarily fault Mr. Resch for that, because I think he moved five ways to Sundays to bring Mr. Carrillo down and have him be part of the hearing. Why did the state say, we don't think we need to bring him down? Because that was what seemed to be the last straw for the court to then say, yep, we don't need to bring him down. We're just going to take it under advisement.
So I think ultimately at the time, the state's perspective and the attorney that was there handling that issue took it from the way that the discussion takes place on the record was that it was more about whether Carrillo was necessary to authenticate the both the letter that was sent originally and then any discussions that were taking place in the memorandum that was given by the investigator. That was the state's position at the time, that that would be duplicative and that that wasn't really necessary. I think that looking back, if the court does want to know what Carrillo would have done, had a couple of perspectives, one which is, would he have won when being told by Mr. Langford, you should not speak to these people, would he have disregarded the advice of the attorney that was representing him on his murder case and still chosen to speak with him? And then two, would he have after the fact decided to testify?
Well, but part of the state's argument here is that even if Mr. Khanna should have done more, that there's no prejudice because this witness would have lacked credibility. But how are we supposed to credit that argument when he could have been called in person as a witness subject to cross-examination, but the state agreed that wasn't necessary?
So, and I think at the time when it was proposed, the state was viewing it from a different context. If the court wants to know what Carrillo would have said and would might have said at the time and what he would have done, it could always remand it with a further proceeding.
It's not up to whether we want to hear it. It's the record you made.
That's your job at that evidentiary hearing, right? And in my mind, particularly more so after reviewing Mr. Cano's testimony, where he said very explicitly that just because we could have talked to him, let's assume he would have talked to us later on, just because of that doesn't mean we would have called him. He would need to be, quote, a good and credible witness, and we'd have to balance everything in our case. Yet you all still said, nope, we don't need to bring him down and ascertain anything about that. So we held defense attorneys to the standard of not doing more without showing what that would have likely resulted in. And in part, it was because the state told the court, you don't need to bring him down.
So I don't know how much more further I can comment on that fact other than that, unfortunately, the record is what the record is. And at this point in time, if the court does have concerns about what he would have said, whether he would have testified, whether he would have disregarded the advice of his counsel, and what that would have looked like in terms of his conversation with Mr. Cano at the time, it could always remand it for that.
I have a question before you sit down, and it concerns prejudice. And taking the statement at face value that Correa wrote, and comparing it to the statement that Zapata makes less than 3 weeks after the victims were killed, he said in that first conversation with the police that we have a transcript of that Jeremias comes out and says he killed the guys and that the plan had just been to rob them and he wasn't going to kill them. And so what's missing in my analysis, and I'd like you to comment when you get back up or else now, is would a juror have attached significance to this statement from Carrillo, assuming he was called, when right after the event, Zapata's statement to the police is consistent with his statement at trial as to Jeremiah's coming out saying, I went in, murdered, and was going to steal from them, but ended up killing them. Like, to me, it doesn't make sense that Zapata wouldn't have said that in the beginning if that were the truth. In other words, what he told Carrillo, why wouldn't he have told the police that?
So since I only have 3 minutes and 20 seconds left, I will absolutely address that question when I come back.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Resch.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jamie Resch here on behalf of Ralph Jeremias. We are not asking the court to do any sweeping new rulemaking here today, but rather to apply basic principles stated for decades in Strickland or in Dolman, this court's version of Strickland. And the questions that are asked in those cases to determine if an attorney was ineffective are whether they were ineffective, and if so, did what they did or didn't do undermine confidence in the outcome of the proceeding? We had a very skeptical trial court in this case. It asked those questions, and it found both answers to be yes. I would suggest there are a couple of background facts that inform us of how the judge reached that decision. The first is, despite all the time spent on this in the state's brief, there is no tactical reason for trial counsel's failure to use the letter or to call Mr. Carrillo as a witness at trial. Trial counsel testified the exclusive reason that the materials were not used was that they could not verify the authenticity of the letter. That was it. Now, there was some discussion about the credibility of Mr. Carrillo, but I think that when that comes up, what it meant in context was his criminal record. There wasn't anything greater to look at other than, did you write the letter? And how does your record affect the proceedings? Counsel would have had to weigh that against what's the benefit of the information that would have been received. I must decline the state's request here today to rewrite history. If they wanted to remand, they should have argued something different below. They conceded, and this is the second point that I want the court to be aware of, there was no need to call Carrillo as a witness. They went further and said that they agreed that he wrote the letter, and if he came to testify, he would have said, yes, that's my letter. That's all the facts that I have to present this court. It's on page 2970 in the record, but it sounds like the court is already familiar with those facts. So when we're thinking about whether counsel was ineffective, it might be best to back up for just a moment. The supplement that we filed More broadly alleged, the trial counsel was ineffective a few ways, either in using Carrillo as a witness or in at least using the letter, which they certainly could have asked Zapata about. If he admits he wrote the letter, well, then you're in the same position you would have been if Carrillo came and said that he received the information from Zapata. None of those things happened. And the reason was that not that there was this other great stuff that counsel could use to make their case, but simply because they weren't able to verify the letter, and that was based on what I guess I will style as a misreading of the rules of professional conduct. It is doubtful in my mind, to begin with, that the rules of professional conduct prohibited them from just reaching out to Carrillo. Our rules are based on the ABA code in large part, and there is a rule 4.2 under the ABA with comments to that rule, which very clearly say, when we say you can't contact a representative party, we mean represented in the same scope of representation, not that they have an attorney for something completely different. And that would have been Carrillo's case. He was in jail, and counsel was able to verify that he's at the Clark County Detention Center, along with Zapata and Jeremias all at the same time. So that part of the story checks out, and it was, in fact, that fact which gave Mr. Carrillo access to Zapata.
Mr. Rush, and I'm sorry, this is probably just my, I want to make sure I understand going back to the issue about what happened at the hearing. My understanding is your investigator communicated with Mr. Carrillo in preparation for your hearing. Is that correct, or preparation for your briefing?
No, that is true. We retained an investigator. They went to meet with Carrillo. They prepared a report, which is in the record, and the state mentioned the report at the hearing, and we provided in the record as well. So,
and Mr. Carrillo at that time confirmed the same story as reflected in the original letter, or not?
No, paraphrasing the report, he basically said, look, that's all the information I have is in the letter. So if he had come to testify, and I think this was one big reason for the trial court's decision on that, you're just going to hear from him, yeah, it's the letter I wrote, and I don't have anything to add to it. Okay, well, that, you know, since the state conceded those facts, there really wasn't a reason to bring him to further explore the issue.
I want to ask you pretty much the same question that I asked counsel for the state, and that is, except for purposes of argument that 4.2 didn't preclude talking to Carrillo, and except that the state conceded that Carrillo, if called, would have said what was in his letter, how do you meet the prejudice standard given that from the start, Zapata was saying that the two of them drove in his truck and they were going to rob him, and Jeremias went in and then came back out and talked about having killed him? That's a consistent statement immediately after the event, and it would have been exculpatory for Zapata to have said what he said to Carrillo, to the police. It would have been like, we went in to rob him, but there was nothing there. So I have some trouble with the concept that the standard for prejudice has been met, which, as I understand that standard, it's reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would have been different. And I'm not getting into the would versus could. I'm getting into factually, why would a juror have attached significance to Carrillo's statement that Zapata told him that no murder occurred that he was involved in or Jeremias was involved in?
Well, that's a great multi-part question. I will do my best.
I understand it's multi-part.
Get you the information. I think if we look at the record as a whole, you see that Zapata's statements to the police in Rios' trial, there was a third co-defendant, okay, at which time Zapata testified. And then, of course, at Jeremiah's trial, the story continues to evolve over time. And so would it have behooved Zapata to just say, look, I don't want to think about anything? I think that was his original statement to the police. And then, of course, he's got items from the two deceased individuals at his apartment or whatever it is. And it's kind of hard to say you don't know anything about anything. So then we come to let's just dump the whole thing on Jeremiah's. And so just to give you a couple examples, okay. Zapata does tell the police about, you know, that he had a wife or a girlfriend and a brand new baby around the time of the murders. That's information that's reflected in Carrillo's letter as well. I think it kind of adds credibility to Carrillo's statement that says, hey, we just made this whole thing up. Zapata's entire strategy was to minimize his role in the events.
But if that were the case, he wouldn't have said that Jeremias came out and told him he'd killed the people when he went in to rob him.
It would have been
a more coherent defense from Zapata's perspective to say, no, we never intended to, and it was bad. He went in the apartment, found him dead, and stole their stuff. But, like, why would Zapata be saying he knew immediately afterwards that Jeremias had confessed and said, yeah, I shot him?
Sure. I mean, I don't pretend to know what was in Zapata's mind at the time. There, you know, were a variety of factors in the case to include, you know, illegal substance use. They've got this plan. And again, maybe he just panicked. I don't know, trying to minimize his role in the events. It's hard to say. I think we only know the information that we have.
But if you posit that Carrillo's letter's truthful, that would have been minimized it way more than what he told the police.
Well, and again,
that's your point on it, right?
I don't know what's in Zapata's mind other than, you know, two people are dead. He has property from those victims right at his apartment. And, you know, there's video of them using credit cards. Kind of hard to say you weren't involved at all. So, you know, obviously, I don't know if this is a bridge too far, but it doesn't seem like Jeremias and Zapata took the time to really coordinate anything, which I think actually lends credibility to what Jeremias is saying, is that they were deceased at the time that he went in there.
Yeah. And what is the legal standard in your estimation on prejudice that we should apply?
Okay. Well, it is stated in Strickland and in Dolman. And again, I realize a lot of briefing was spent on the issue of could versus would. I would just suggest the answer is a lot closer to could than it is to would. Strickland asks whether the result of the proceeding would have been different, but we're asking about a reasonable probability that it would have been different, yeah. Not just that it would have been different. I think in Dolman, this court used the word could, and I think that in totality, that's a lot more accurate. So now when we talk about prejudice, I mean, Strickland goes on to say it's a question of whether confidence in the result has been undermined, which I realize is kind of nebulous, but I think it's a totality question. You look at the sum of the evidence and ask yourself, well, can I really be sure that this would have been the outcome of the case had this evidence been presented? In this particular case, again, that's one of the main problems. This is evidence that it isn't just an inconsistent statement or something that doesn't match up. I mean, this is evidence of actual fabrication. We cited three circuit court cases in our brief that all dealt with similar issues of ineffectiveness and so-called unused impeachment evidence, and they all universally found that that's a really big mistake, especially when you're dealing with the state's so-called star witness and, you know, something that goes to the credibility of that person. Again, in this case, it goes beyond that. It goes to whether he just completely made up the story. So just in response to some of what we heard earlier here today, I would suggest the rules already exist in terms of ineffectiveness. They're stated in those circuit cases. And we have to ask ourselves, if we're talking about a serious evidence, again, on the question of prejudice, the only evidence that, you know, Jeremias admitted to the murder, that he had a gun, that he had that gun in a plastic bag, this all comes from Zapata. And so, again, I just wanted to mention, and the court brought this up earlier, when Zapata first talks to the police, he really doesn't mention the plastic bag. It's only at trial, and this is, again, on page 42 in the record. The police ask Zapata, where was the gun? And he's like, well, it was in his pocket or in his hand. I don't know. The answer is ultimately, I don't know. He doesn't mention anything about a plastic bag. That's something that comes up at trial, and it's obviously when linked to those charges that are found makes a compelling case for guilt. But something that exclusively comes from this witness. And so the things that go to undermine his credibility are the things that are the core of the state's case. And so when you take that away, I would suggest it undermines confidence in the verdict. It, in fact, makes it look a wholly different light. And so for that reason, it would meet the standard of prejudice under Strickland or Dolman.
What in your mind, Mr. Resch, what is there in the record for the district court that showed or would give her a comfort level that had he been called, Mr. Carrillo would have come and testified? Because, look, we all of us that are involved in the criminal justice system can imagine a guy doing 19, 85 years on murder. Some inmates may say, I'm not coming to court. I don't want to be involved in that. I don't like the appearance of that. I'm going to be in prison for a really long time. I'm not doing it. Others may say, no, that's fine. I know he said, I stand by the letter, but what is there in the record that showed, and this is why I was asking the question of the state as well, I know you asked multiple times to have him brought down, but absent that having occurred, because it didn't, what is there in the record that shows that he would have cooperated had the defense attorneys continued to push the issue?
I appreciate that, and it's something I've given a lot of thought to. We did want him to come to the evidentiary hearing. The state resisted it, and they ultimately agreed that he didn't need to. So to the extent the district court's decision is based on those facts, that's the record that we have at this time. As far as a direct answer to your question, I would just put it this way. I think the district court found, and they didn't spell this out so much, but that substantial evidence supported the inference that he would have at least said, I wrote the letter. And that's really the only key fact that the trial counsel wanted to confirm, is that this wasn't something that Jeremias just wrote in his free time and you know, Mr. Carrillo actually didn't know anything about it. So I think it is a reasonable evidence. Sorry. There's substantial evidence to support the reasonable inference that by writing the letter, he would have at least confirmed, yes, that's my letter. It's signed by him. It has facts that match up, such as both that, you know, Zapata is in jail with him and the facts about the baby and the girlfriend. Those are all things that check out. So I think when you add those up, this is how I would take what the trial court did, that they found that the letter was authentic based on the state's concessions and based on the statements that we knew from the record that by writing the letter and giving it to Jeremias, there's at least an inference that he would have said, yes, that's my letter, and I expected it to be used. So, you know, could the court have gone deeper and just confirmed that he would have testified? Well, I just want to be clear that our position in the supplement was a little broader than that. Certainly one issue is that he could have testified and sent the information, hey, here's what Zapata told me. Like, he could have done that. But we had the letter, too, and so also trial counsel could have used the letter. Zapata testified. He could have showed him the letter. He could have produced it to the state in advance.
How would they have done that?
Well, a couple ways. I mean, you can always ask Zapata, hey, did you write this letter? Now, of course, if he says no, then you've got some difficulties.
Well, it's not alleged that Zapata wrote the letter. It's alleged
Carrillo.
Sorry, Carrillo wrote the letter. Right, so if you ask Zapata, hey, do you know this inmate Carrillo, and did you tell him these statements, and see what his response is? If he denies it, well, then I had suggested in the supplement there were ways to try to use just the letter alone, such as the residual hearsay exception or general rules that simply treat death penalty cases as more serious than other cases. It you know, arguably would have arose to a violation of his rights to just, especially if the state had the same information, if they gave them a copy of the letter, to just pretend that it didn't exist. It did exist. Now, the better way to approach it was, of course, to have talked to Carrillo and confirm that he wrote the letter. But I think that we were able to do that just based on the fact that it's never been in dispute that he wrote the letter. And that was the one fact that trial counsel wanted to verify.
When your investigator talked to Carrillo and he said, yeah, I wrote the letter and don't have anything else to add, I guess, was he directly asked if he'd be willing to testify?
I don't know that we have that in the report, so I want to step a little shy of that. But again, the fact that
I don't want you to go beyond the record.
I'm sure. Just asking. The fact that he would or wouldn't have testified, I think once you know that the letter is authentic, you have everything you need to subpoena the guy, and it's not really up to him. And even if at that point he says, may I finish my response?
Yes, please.
Even if at that point he says, I'm not going to cooperate, you still put him on the stand. And at that point, if he denies writing the letter, I think you're in a much stronger position as trial counsel to confront him with it or to call Ralph, who could have said, well, he did write the letter. He gave it to me, and that's why it's here. So for all those reasons, I would suggest there is no need to remand the matter. And in fact, the best outcome would be to affirm the grant of the new trial.
May I ask one other question, Chief?
Go ahead.
I didn't think I saw it anywhere. I know it wasn't in the evidentiary hearing testimony or in the judge's order, but I just want to make sure I didn't miss it anywhere else in the record. Was there anything about anybody following up in anticipation of the post-conviction writ hearings with Mr. Langford?
I can only suggest that as, okay. Again, in the record, I don't know that we have anything. My recollection is I might have reached out to him, but it was, no contradictory information was received. So
okay.
I think that, we kind of have what we have at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? No. Thank you. Mr. Elder. Do you say it Elder or Eldar?
Eldar.
Okay. Mr. Eldar.
I want to look at it from the perspective of even if Carrillo, if we take it from the perspective of believing that Carrillo would have testified, believing that he would have testified to what is in the letter, that there was so much evidence of overwhelming guilt in this case. And to get to the question that you answered or that you asked me earlier, is that Zapata's statement is, he gives a statement to the detective, And then he testifies both in Ivan Rios' case and in this case. And there is so much other evidence, whether it's you look at the fact that there was a witness that saw Zapata's red truck fleeing the scene at the time that loud noises were heard between 4 to 4:30. You look at the fact that, which puts Zapata's car at the scene, and even Jeremias' statements and his testimony that he was basically with Zapata that entire day, nearly the entire day besides.
But now, so there was no physical or forensic evidence placing him at the apartment at the time of the murders, right?
So that is correct, but his own statement puts, at the time of the murders, there is no physical, I mean, you wouldn't be able to get DNA evidence that said he was there at 4:30 versus 5. There was nothing, there's no surveillance video, that's kind of what you're getting at.
The one eyewitness that saw them entering the apartment said that she didn't hear any gunshots, that he went upstairs. I'm just having a hard time with the concept of this, there being overwhelming evidence against Jeremias, and that this letter would not have at least persuaded the jury otherwise.
So here's, the briefing discusses the overwhelming evidence in the sense of there's all this evidence that corroborates exactly what Zapata is saying. The witness puts the red truck at the scene. A separate witness puts Jeremias in the area of the apartment around in the early afternoon of the day. You've got the fact that Jeremias knows things that only the person who committed these offenses could know. For example, the gunshot wounds to the head that was discussed at the trial. You've got the fact that there is all of these facts that Zapata can only know if Jeremias tells him what happens inside that building.
Or if Zapata was the shooter, right?
Right.
So the problem with that is that there really isn't a credible time frame to make Zapata the shooter in this case. So for example, Jeremias' statement at trial was that they go from the Hooters back to Ivan Rios' apartment. They go that he leaves Ivan Rios there, him and Zapata then go to a barbershop. That is the only time period that Zapata, even under under a theory that Jeremias presents, could be the shooter. And the problem with that, it doesn't make sense, because why would Zapata go commit these murders, then go back to Jeremias and say, hey, let's go talk to the people that I just killed, and you should go in there and get the marijuana from them.
So Zapata says they went in his truck to the apartment. He says Jeremias went in and shot them and came back out.
Yes.
If we don't have Zapata saying that, couldn't the evidence also be Jeremias was in the car and Zapata went in and shot the people and came back out? Wouldn't that be the same timeline?
So and I think that the state's argument in its briefing regarding whether this is felony murder versus some other kind of theory, it goes to that even if you were to believe that we can't prove that there's so much credibility in terms of Zapata's statement of who actually went into this building to kill these people, that it is clear that there was some sort of agreement, that there was substantial evidence, even without Zapata's statements, that Jeremias was there. Jeremias was with Zapata the entire time, and there was an agreement to commit a robbery inside that building, which ended up in the deaths of those two victims. So in terms of that, that would be the state's position.
Sure. Zapata was given some kind of deal in exchange for his testimony?
So it is in the record that Zapata did plead guilty to, I believe it was second degree murder, ultimately sentenced to a period of 10 to 25 years.
In a different case.
Zapata?
Yes.
No, maybe you're thinking of Daniel. Daniel Carrillo did plead guilty in a separate case. To a murder that Daniel Carrillo is unrelated to this
Zapata's
case.
Plea was to second degree murder related to these victims?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
When was that plea entered?
Give me one moment. It was entered prior to, let me see if I have it right here, but it was entered, he was convicted at the time of the trial.
Right, but when did he enter the plea, do you know?
I believe my notes are indicating November 2nd, 2010.
Okay, so 15 months after he was interviewed by the police.
That is correct.
Or longer, correct. 16.
About 15 to 16 months. And did I answer your question?
Well, I was just saying, in exchange for that plea deal, he agreed to testify against Mr. Jeremias, correct?
There was an agreement, and I think that that was explored actually by Mr. Cano at the time on the record. I know that my time is up. The only thing that I would ask the court is that you reverse the district court's ruling and that you do not rely on the harsh light of hindsight and cast doubt on a trial that took place 9 years ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your arguments this morning.